Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Joseph Lorenzo Hall of the Center for Democracy and Technology, who explains why his group supports Apple's defiance of a court order to unlock the iPhone used by a deceased terrorist in the San Bernardino massacre. Ron Allen, chairman of the Jamestown Tsklallam tribe in Washington State, who discusses the labyrinth of government agencies that indigenous leaders must navigate to protect their people's rights. And Kai Newkirk, campaign director with the group Democracy Spring, who talks about plans for a massive civil disobedience action at the U.S. Capitol in April to protest the corrupting influence of big money in U.S. politics. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A new report by the Syrian Center for Policy Research estimates that 470,000 people have been killed in Syria's five-year civil war, nearly double the count made by the United Nations. To put the death toll in perspective, the report concluded that nearly 12% of Syria's total population have lost their lives during the civil conflict. As major cities like Aleppo remain under siege, the World Food Program has begun aerial food drops to feed embattled civilians in eastern Syria, an area largely controlled by ISIS. The report estimates 400,000 Syrians have been killed directly from the violence, while 70,000 have died as a result of inadequate medical care and lack of clean water and sanitation. In Munich, world powers agreed to seek a nationwide cessation of hostilities in Syria. However, there's skepticism the ceasefire can successfully be implemented. Since the agreement was signed, the BBC reports three hospitals and two schools were hit with missile strikes. France and Turkey accused Russia of launching the missile attack, a charge that Russia has denied. The group Doctors Without Borders, which runs hospitals in opposition-controlled zones in Syria, says it has stopped sharing GPS coordinates with Russian and Syrian military officials, who view health facilities run by non-governmental groups as legitimate military targets. After a three-year federal study of 7,500 people who had worked at the Union Carbide Vinyl Chloride plant in Texas City, Texas, over a 30-year period, health researchers identified 23 brain tumor cases in plant workers. In the early 1980s, vinyl chloride, a chemical used in the making of PVC plastic, was seen as a prime culprit in causing brain cancers. But a generation later, there is still no conclusive research on the impact vinyl chloride has on human health, and the chemical remains in common use. Recently, an in-depth review of health studies on vinyl chloride by the Center for Public Integrity found that key evidence was ignored in influential industry-sponsored studies. The center revealed nearly 24 brain tumor victims were purposely excluded from the vinyl chloride studies. Despite tougher workplace rules on vinyl chloride in the 1970s, chemical plants still emit over 500,000 tons of vinyl chloride into the air annually, impacting surrounding communities. But the Environmental Protection Agency is now considering implementing stricter emissions limits for vinyl chloride and other chemicals discharged by PVC plants. In the last few years, New York City car wash workers, most of whom are immigrants, have successfully conducted union organizing drives at 10 car washes, doubling their take-home pay with a contract negotiated by the Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Workers Union. The union is allied with activist community groups including Make the Road New York and New York Communities for Change. Workers now receive overtime pay, vacation days, and paid sick days. In June 2015, the New York City Council enacted a new law requiring car wash owners to obtain an operating license annually. Owners must verify that the businesses provide workers just compensation and unemployment insurance. City licenses can be denied to car wash owners convicted of wage theft or underpayment of wages. But implementation of the new law has been held up by a lawsuit filed by the Association of Car Wash Owners that claims the law creates a two-tier system that imposes greater restrictions on non-unionized shops, an alleged violation of due process and equal protection rights. The advocacy campaign Wash New York says a delay in the implementation of the car wash law is harming immigrant workers. The campaign, backed by veteran community organizers, says car wash workers are often denied protective gear like gloves and goggles in handling harsh shampoos and detergents, with few receiving any health insurance or compensation to cover on-the-job injuries. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
A federal judge issued an order on February 16th requiring the Apple Computer Company to produce software for the FBI that can unlock the iPhone used by one of the deceased terrorists who killed 14 people and wounded 22 at a holiday party at the Inland Regional Center in San Bernardino, California, on December 2nd last year. The order does not ask Apple to break the phone's encryption, but rather to disable the iPhone's feature that deletes all data on the phone after a user enters an incorrect password 10 times. In explaining Apple's decision to defy the court order, the company's CEO, Tim Cook, said such a step would dangerously weaken iPhone security. Once created, Cook maintained, the technique could be used over and over again on any number of devices. In the physical world, it would be the equivalent of a master key, capable of opening hundreds of millions of locks, from restaurants and banks to stores and homes. Cook went on to say, opposing this order is not something we take lightly. We feel we must speak up in the face of what we see as an overreach by the U.S. government. Instead, Cook says, the government should withdraw its request and appoint a commission to explore the issues of security and privacy. Your reporter spoke with Joseph Lorenzo Hall, chief technologist with the Center for Democracy and Technology. Here he talks about his group's support for Apple's refusal to unlock the iPhone and build a backdoor that can be used for surveillance by law enforcement or exploited by hackers.
What the FBI is asking for is for Apple to create a new version of their iOS operating system. Essentially, you can think of that as FBIOS instead of iOS, which is the term that Apple calls its operating system, and produce a version that doesn't technically defeat the encryption that the iPhone and other Apple iOS devices use. It's actually quite strong, but instead sort of messes around with the glue that keeps the encryption pieces together and sort of what makes it much easier to not have to use the encryption, so to speak. So if you think of it as encryption as a door that you can lock to protect the stuff on your phone, they're asking Apple to sort of weaken the frame that the door stands in, so to speak. And in this case, the thing that troubles a lot of us, on the one hand, is a company being sort of forced by the government to create a tool of surveillance, a version of the operating system that doesn't have the protections that the normal version does, specifically for eavesdropping. And we're concerned with a number of things. For example, if this thing were to get out and it not be properly controlled so that it only ran on that one phone, that one horrible person's phone who killed a bunch of people, that if this were to get out, that potentially this could be used on any number of the hundreds of millions of iOS devices. And more importantly, this means that the regular investigations, so not national security or terrorism investigations, will now be potentially, those kinds of techniques could be used on a whole number of other devices. And so you can imagine the Googles, the Facebooks of the world being required to hand over data that they never actually possessed, but they created specifically for the government to aid in either criminal investigations or other kinds of surveillance activities.
Joseph, is there any room for compromise here in your view where Apple, for example, could extract the data from this particular phone used by this alleged terrorist and not give the FBI a backdoor to all of its smartphones?
When it comes to compromise, Apple has cooperated quite a bit with this investigation, very willingly. You know, the people who run the compliance departments at these companies really want to see things work out in the sense that, you know, have people have agents get the data they need to investigate these hard cases. The trick here is that, you know, this kind of thing is going to be used not only in those kinds of cases, but many, many other cases. And so when it comes to compromise, I think we've gone a little past that to the point where, you know, we want to make sure that everyone can know that if, you know, you send a message on an iOS device and it's blue, you know, I tell people if it's blue, that means you're protected. And the only keys that reside that can you know, decrypt that individual message lie on your phone and the other phone in the communication. And that gives people quite a bit of confidence to use that for a variety of things. And unfortunately, if there is a compromise that results in many, 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 many phones becoming transparent to law enforcement in the future, people are going to stop using these devices for more important things in their life, like intimate activities, like, you know, finance and health kinds of things. And that's really some of the things we worry about in the scope of compromise.
Well, just a final question. Apple CEO Tim Cook has called on the FBI to withdraw its demand for a backdoor to iPhone encryption and instead participate in a national commission to debate the issues of privacy and security and to take on some of the difficult issues here in this case with the iPhone and connected to the San Bernardino massacre.
Here, a lot of us have been saying, look, let's not talk so much or spend our time, wasting our time, frankly, with these very, very heavy-duty legal cases and these deep, deep technical questions that are very, very hard to explain. And instead, you know, we should spend our time thinking about, you know, what are the police going to do and the intelligence agencies of the world going to do when the world is increasingly ubiquitously encrypted or, you know, just very complicated kinds of things. That's what we need to spend time on, not trying to sort of preserve the vestiges of the past in terms of, you know, wiretapping and putting two little alligator clips on a copper phone line to listen in on bad guys. You know, bad guys, the sophisticated bad guys, know what they're doing. They know how to avoid these things. And so having a really deep investigation, discussion, commission, whatever you want to call it, into alternatives getting access to this information and the kinds of capabilities that our law enforcement entities are going to need increasingly in the future to be able to combat crime, that's where we want to spend our time, not things that hanging in the balance is, you know, the potential insecurity of hundreds of millions of people in their phones.
That was Joseph Lorenzo Hall, chief technologist with the Center for Democracy and Technology. Find more perspectives on Apple's defiance of the court order to unlock the iPhone used by a deceased terrorist in the San Bernardino massacre by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On February 19th and 20th, Yale Law School hosted the 22nd Annual Rebellious Lawyering Conference, known as Reb Law. The conference, grounded in the spirit of rebel lawyer Gerald Lopez, seeks to build a community of law students, practitioners, and activists seeking to work in the service of social change movements and to challenge hierarchies of race, wealth, gender, and expertise within legal practice and education. Conference organizers this year scheduled 25 panel discussions on topics including data and privacy, international tribunals on Palestine and other nations, youth organizing, and several on criminal justice reform. One of the panels, titled Self-Determination in Tribal Nations, a Leadership Perspective, featured two tribal chiefs, Lynn Malerba of the Mohegan Nation in Connecticut, and Ron Allen, who served as chairman of the Jamestown Tsklallam Tribe in Washington State since 1977. In a wide-ranging and animated talk, Allen, who's 68 years old, told his audience that he's nowhere near ready to retire, and discussed all the local, state, national, and tribal agencies and organizations he said Native American leaders must interact with, noting that the battles to protect the rights of our people is not on the res, it's outside the res. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, who attended the Rebellious Lawyering Conference, recorded and produced the following excerpt of Ron Allen's talk.
Now you got the federal government, you're dealing with the Congress, you're dealing with the Senate, the House, you're dealing with their staff, you deal with the, essentially, you got to go to their, the executive branch and all the different departments, the different agencies. We have tribal advisory councils. Lynn and I serve on the Department of Justice advisory for AG. We're meeting with them this week, next week. And then we've got HHS. They have an advisory. We sit on that one as well. We have one with the Department of Interior. I just got appointed to the one on the Department of Treasury. It's a new one, dealing with Treasury and access to capital, taxation rules and regulations and so forth. And it goes on and on. Every agency, EPA, and you name it, you have to deal with them. Then you deal with the federal court system. You know, we deal with all of our lawyers. We deal with the clerks. We interface with them. You engage with them. For example, two of us went and talked to the Ninth Circuit, all 57 judges. And talk to them about Indian law, and their chief justice, a guy named Krasinski. Then you deal with the federal government and their national and their independent agencies. For us, you know, the National Indian Gaming Commission is one of them. They deal with regulations. All these other federal agencies that affect our interests, FCC, Navy, Army Corps of Engineers, National Park, they're all independent agencies out there. They affect our interests, they affect our cultural rights, and we have to interface with them. Then we go to the state government. So we deal with the state government. Same thing. So you deal with the executive branch, the governor, and all the different departments. You go over and deal with the legislature. Same thing, Senate, House, and all their staff. You deal with the judicial system in the state because some of your cases end up in state court, even though they shouldn't be in the state court. So you have to deal with them. You have to understand how it does apply, how does it not apply. Then you've got the independent agencies. And like in our state, as an example, there's a state gaming agency. They negotiate with us over compacts and with regard to business practices, respecting the government-to-government relationship. And it's always a challenge for them, make them respect your government-to-government. We're not asking permission. We're asking for cooperation and collaboration. Then, what else do we deal? Well, the media always wants to know what's going on. So, marijuana is legal in your state. What's your position? Well, I used to like it a lot, you know. But anyhow, then I had to get serious, you know. So, what's your tribe going to do? You're going to grow it? You're going to sell it? You know, and so, yeah, and that's just one example. There's a ton of things going on. And so you're dealing with the public education system. You're dealing with every different level. Try to keep it in perspective. And my favorite phrase is balance. Keep it in balance. Don't get flustered by it. You know, stay focused on whatever the current issue is that's at hand. And not to worry about it, but remember, you have a fundamental job. You have fundamental responsibility. You may have to divvy up the responsibility. But you do want to encourage a couple of things. You want to encourage trust. You want to encourage patience. You want to encourage the citizenship to be supportive of those who are out in the front line. Because the battle to protect our rights is not on the res. It's outside the res. That's where it's at. That's where the action's at. And there's a lot more to it. I'll close my remarks. But the other question is that who are you mentoring? That's what happens to me a lot of times with those of us who have been in the helm for a while. Who are you mentoring? Well, you can't make somebody a leader. You want to find the ones that want to be a leader. And then once you find them, then give them everything you can give them, just as fast as they can take it. And so they emerge. I'm one who has great trust. They will emerge. They will emerge to lead, and we'll continue to grow. The 21st century is just nothing but an opportunity for us, and it's exciting for us. And I do want to make one final point. Whatever people think about Obama, he has changed Indian country in a phenomenal way. We have many, many challenges. And one of the things that he's done is when he said, he promised us he would meet with us every year, Clinton met with us once in 8 years. Obama's met with us every year. Every year, 350 to 400 of us will show up at the White House and meet with him and talk about our issue. His whole cabinet, they're required to be there. And so that's a big deal. Now, whoever the next president is, we're not going back. So you better step up and recognize that you got this relationship with us. And that's our job because, like Lynn was saying, you know, we're not necessarily table thumpers, but we're close to it.
That was Ron Allen, chairman of the Jamestown Sklallam Tribe of Washington State. Learn more about the Rebellious Lawyering Conference in the Sklallam Tribe by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. For the first time in recent U.S. history, candidates competing to win their party's nomination to run in the 2016 presidential election have been forced to address what many Americans believe to be their nation's broken political system and economy, rigged in favor of the wealthiest individuals and powerful corporations. While Vermont's independent Senator Bernie Sanders has devoted his campaign to articulating these grievances more than any other candidate, others vying for the White House, including Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, have to a lesser degree also emphasized the failings of America's current political and economic status quo. Now, with record-breaking unregulated campaign spending by unaccountable donors through super PACs, plans are underway to organize a massive civil disobedience action at the U.S. Capitol this April, acknowledging the urgent need to address the crisis in U.S. politics. Those participating in the peaceful protest will demand that Congress take immediate legislative action to end the corruption of big money in politics, protect the right to vote, and ensure free and fair elections that give every American an equal voice. Organizers of the action called Democracy Spring say more than 2,000 individuals from around the country, including Mark Ruffalo, Larry Lessig, and Zephyr Teachout, have pledged to risk arrest in the nonviolent sit-in at the U.S. Capitol. Your reporter spoke with Kai Newkirk, campaign director with Democracy Spring, who talks about plans for what he says will be one of the largest civil disobedience actions in a generation, and the goals of the protest in this important election year.
I think we're in a really critical moment for our country. I think the vast majority of American people, Republican, Democrat, Independent, across the board, agree that our democracy is in crisis and that the role of a moneyed elite, the 1% of the billionaire class, and their power in our democracy is out of control. And the combination of this huge and growing role of money in our politics, defining and dominating our elections, creating a wealth primary that excludes folks who don't have access to great wealth from being able to run and be competitive and win. The combination of that and these attacks on this fundamental right to vote are giving us a government that is really functioning as a plutocracy, in which a tiny group of oligarchs has real power in our country and is setting policy and running things in their interest and not the interest of the public. And yet, despite that, we're not seeing any action from Congress to do anything about this problem. They're wedded to this corrupt status quo. And we feel that this is something that the American people, that we cannot accept any further. All the problems that we face as a country, from catastrophic climate change to historic economic inequality, mass incarceration, the things that are impacting folks in our daily lives across the country, your listeners, the things that are impacting us in our lives, we can't fully solve those problems unless we fix and save our democracy and have a government that's of, by, and for the people and as a means to solve our problems. And so we are motivated in Democracy Spring by this sense of urgency that we have to come together and confront Congress and force a reckoning with this issue. And when we look back through the history of progress in our country, we see, in my view, that there has never been great advancement on dealing with the fundamental problems that we face and taking this promise of democracy and extending it and trying to make it real without people being willing to step up in the tradition of nonviolent action and take mass action, mass civil disobedience, and to challenge and disrupt business as usual and force the conversation to challenge the status quo and say there has to be change. And that's what we're going to do in Democracy Spring. This is going to be one of the largest civil disobedience actions in a generation in our country. It's going to be something that no one can ignore. And we think that the days that we arrive in Washington, D.C. at the Capitol and sit in will be the days in which this corruption began to end.
Kai, give us some details about who's participating that may be known to our listeners, as well as the numbers of people that you're expecting to be at the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. to stage a sit-in that may very well result in mass arrests.
That's right. It's a coalition of over 90 organizations that have come together in Democracy Spring, representing Americans from many different walks of life and folks that are organized in different movements that have come together to organize this campaign. And over 2,000 people have already pledged to risk arrest, have said that they will be there in Washington, D.C. to sit in at the People's House to take it back, and they're willing to go to jail if necessary to press this point. And there are many public figures as well who are among those numbers already. The actor Mark Ruffalo, Gabby Hoffman, movement leaders like Lauren Schlesig, Cenk Uygur from the Young Turks, Ben Cohen from Ben & Jerry's, Sefer Teachout, Humi Sella from the Dream Defenders, Medea Benjamin from Code Pink, many others are coming together and stepping up and are willing to take this action at this time, which we know is critical. April 2nd is actually when the campaign is going to begin. We're going to come together in Philadelphia at the Liberty Bell, where we put down on paper and made a commitment as a country to this idea of citizen equality, political equality, of a one-person, one-vote system that has never yet fully been realized, but it must be in our time. So we're going to come together there to make our demand to Congress, simply to say you have to listen to the people that are demanding this change. The vast majority of Americans want this change, and it's time for Congress to take action, to do its job, and to solve this problem and ensure that we have free and fair elections that give everyone an equal voice. There are steps, solutions that they could take right now, bills that they could pass right now that would advance that. And after the death of Justice Scalia, there's another step that they can take, which is to confirm a nominee to the Supreme Court that would also represent this will of the vast majority of the American people and would vote to overturn Citizens United and the Shelby County decision that gutted the Voting Rights Act. And we're not just going to make that demand and say, hey, this is what we want you to do. We're going to say, this is what you must do. And we're going to march 10 days from Philadelphia on April 2nd to the Capitol in Washington, D.C. And when we arrive, if Congress has still not heeded this demand, still unwilling to do anything, then we're going to reclaim the People's House and mass nonviolent sit-ins, which we're prepared to continue until they take action and do their job, or send so many of us to jail that it will be the largest civil disobedience of this century, and send a message that the American people are fed up and demand change now, a message that no one can ignore.
That was Kai Newkirk, campaign director with Democracy Spring, which is organizing a massive civil disobedience action at the U.S. Capitol this April. For more information about the Democracy Spring and Democracy Awakening actions in Washington, D.C., visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.